From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Nothing changed the face of my youth more dramatically than the introduction of television. We became a nation of people who sat in front of television sets. Today we'll look at a new technology which will change our relationship with TV forever. David Lockton is the CEO and chairman of Interactive Network. By simply adding a new twist to our existing TV game shows, primetime murder mysteries, and Super Bowls, Interactive Network now is available with over 120 hours of television programming every day. I'll talk to him about what we can expect and how this service will be rolling out across the United States this year. While 40 years of television has undeniably affected American life, something which also has changed is our orientation to the world. Katie Moran is the executive director of the Healing Forest Conservancy. We'll look at the status of the rainforest and how we can now understand the critical need to maintain the biodiversity of the planet. Since we've all talked about interactive television for so long, I'm reminded of Paul Sappho's remark, "Don't confuse a clear view with a short distance." David Lockton is the CEO and chairman of Interactive Network. I asked him if interactive television was really here and if it had arrived in the time frame he expected.
It's going to arrive at different times for different services, Moira, but interactive television will be driven, as all technologies are, by entertainment. And the entertainment application, which is what Interactive Network is addressing, is here now, and we're just getting ready to go nationwide in the fall.
How long have you been working on this?
Well, under the name Interactive Network, over 6 years, but the technology, the underlying technology and the software platform really dates back to 1981.
So you've been almost 15 years in the making.
A little bit, a little bit of time.
Does it look like what you thought it was going to look like?
Amazingly, yes. I think that what's happened that has been a surprise is the receptivity and the interest in interactive television and the information highway that we couldn't predict nor have anything to do to influence. And so just about the time that we're ready to go nationwide, there seems to be an enormous public interest in all of this area right now.
Well, that sort of ties into the philosopher, and I just lost who he was, who basically said, look, if you want to do it, just begin, because all kinds of things will come into play.
That's right. That's our philosophy, too.
Now, I think people really want to hear some details. What does it mean? What do they do? How does it all work?
Well, what we're doing is taking existing television programming, the kind that you watch, Americans spend an average of almost 7 hours a day watching, and by taking existing technology, we are able to simulcast or to send information that is synchronized with that programming that involves the viewer in a variety of ways. It allows you in sporting events, which is a large part of television fare, for instance, to compete against one another, second-guessing the coach, the quarterback, the manager, depending on the sport. And you're doing that in real time simultaneously with a telecast. Game shows, Paul Sappho has pointed out that this technology does not require its participants to change an existing behavior pattern. You must answer a game show question in your head, at least, if you're watching. So we will enable people to play against one another and ultimately against the contestants in real time for prizes. And it goes on from there.
Now let's get that. I'm sort of fascinated. I'm a pretty big football fan, and I've always found myself sitting there going, you know, run, Ricky, you
know. Exactly.
It's like, so I put in run, Ricky.
Well, exactly. That's exactly right. What you do is you must predict what you think the quarterback will call before the ball is snapped, and you can change your mind as many times as you want up until that point, but you're locked in basically with your last selection when the play is underway. So you could say that it's just going to be a run or a pass. If you want to win more points, to the risk of of losing more, you might say it's going to be a run over the middle or a pass to the right. And then if you want to go all the way, you might say it's a pass to the right with play action to Ricky Waters. And if you got all of those things right, you would get a great big bushel of points. But the thing about it is, as you say, that's what people are doing in their mind, or at least anticipating, and they're saying what they should do. And they're looking at the formation on the field, the down and distance, and they're saying, you know, my team always does this in this situation, and then they try to get that in before the ball snapped.
But the whole level of entertainment on top of the entertainment.
It really leverages what people already have a lot of fun with and enables them to win prizes and to prove how really good they were and how much they've mastered their team's proclivities. All of those kinds of things work in making this a value-added entertainment experience.
Now, we're going to talk a little later about where it is now, where it's going to go to, but I think the first thing people have to understand is they got to go out and buy a piece of equipment. Now, tell us about that.
As with all technologies, there is an enabling piece of hardware. Sometimes it's invisible. It's built into a TV set. Sometimes it's separate. And with all new technologies, usually it arrives in the home in a separate package. In this case, it's a wonderful wireless device called the Interactive Control Unit, which we will lease for, like cable, for a flat monthly fee, or you can buy and then pay a flat monthly fee. So it's not necessary to purchase the hardware. But that is a device that has its own display. It has configured like an ATM machine so that you can label a variety of buttons with different things for different games. It has a hidden alphanumeric keyboard. It fits in your lap nicely. But with that, you're able to play along with virtually any kind of television programming we're offering, and we offer about 130 events a day now interactively.
Okay, so you've got something that almost looks like the detachable keyboard on your computer, possibly a little smaller.
It's a little bit smaller, and it's not wired, and it has its own display. But that's as close a familiar object, I guess, that people would understand what it looks like.
Now, how does the information get to it?
It's broadcast in the air, and I use the analogy of stereo television, and the PBS stations pioneered the concept of the FM stereo simulcast, which, as we know, is a situation where you may have an opera or a symphony, and you were told before the event to turn off the sound on the TV and tune in to KQED-FM, and miraculously you will hear a stereo broadcast that is perfectly synchronized with the picture. That's exactly what we're doing. We're sending data on the subcarrier of stations like KQED. Wirelessly, that is generated in real time by our data jockeys or our game producers, that's synchronized with that television programming that's basically controlling your participation in the programming you're watching. So eventually it gets built into the TV set and the cable box, very much the way stereo itself became incorporated into those chassis. But right now it's a
separate.
That's
the vehicle.
Right.
And that happens so much, it's a question of, do we really care how the data gets from here to there, as long as it gets from
exactly
here to there?
Exactly, right. And the way we collect the data, because the whole point is to see how you did and whether you won a prize and to see graphically, whether you were promoted to another skill level, is that we use a device that's in all homes, the telephone, and we make an 8-second digital call into the largest data highway in the world, the MCI TimeNet system, and we bring those scores back and process them, and in a matter of minutes we tell everybody how they did so they can see tonight whether they won anything and what their percentile standing was.
That's incredible. I'm not supposed to say that. I'm not supposed to be awed by technology. It's like this. I'm just overwhelmed. Okay, so let me just take the my 49er example. Okay, I gave away which team I root for. over the wires comes some information. Over the radio waves, and you've got a sort of basically a radio station that you can't hear, but
exactly
data is coming in.
What's fascinating, I think, and what everybody really gets excited about when they come and visit us is to watch what goes on behind the screen, and that is the live production of those events. And so If you were to come in our studio right now, you would see teams of people watching television in Chicago, South Bend, Indiana, what other games are seen in the Bay Area. And what they're basically doing is generating digitally a play-by-play. They punch a button when the pitch leaves the pitcher's hand. In a basketball game, they record every single statistic that is recorded in that basketball game in real time. That gets broadcast out simultaneously with the television picture, and with depending on the point of the game, those statistics are not only there for you to read at any time so you can see what's going on in the game and get deep down into those statistics that the sports fan love to have access to, and this is a unique body of statistics in that they're real time. But those are controlling you, so there's a lockout signal sent when the ball is snapped that says you're frozen in, and then the spotter who's watching the screen, when he's soon as he's sure it's a run, says run, and the guy to his left, the data jockey, will click on a mouse run, and that goes out over the air, and so you know so that you got the run part right. And then it's left, and it was Ricky Waters, and it was good for 7 yards, and it's first and 10. You get a first down bonus. And to watch them do that on an error-free basis under the pressure of knowing that people are out there competing for prizes is a fascinating thing to see.
These are definitely game players.
These are a uniquely talented group of young men and women.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is David Lochtin, CEO and Chairman of Interactive Network, pioneering the field of interactive television. Okay, so I sat there through the 49er game, and I did all my calls, and, you know, I missed some because I had to go and get some chips and dip. But anyway, at the end, I have on my control unit, which also has some display area, I then take that over to a telephone.
Right. It has a built-in modem, and so we would supply you as what we call a splitter, so you would plug that in your nearest convenient phone jack, so you have a separate way of accessing that, and a cord. So you would take the control unit over and plug it in to the back of the unit and just punch one button, score button, and go to get something out of the refrigerator, and that's about an 8-second transaction. And then when the scoring window closes in approximately 4 minutes, then there's a beep, and then up comes the results, and you can see the names of the winner, how you did from a percentile standing, graphically where you were placed on the curve with all of the players. All of that kind of feedback that really is the point of all that what you've been doing for 3 hours.
How does information about my performance get back to me? Is that over the phone line?
When you punch the score button and you hook this up to your phone, you would have to get your children off the phone if they're talking to their boy or girlfriends, because you need to make an 8-second outbound call. That is dumped into a digital pipeline that's ubiquitous in the United States. It's a local call from virtually every home. And we trick, it's really the system that's used for credit card authorizations. If you're ever standing in line at the grocery store and they take your card through a swiper, and in a matter of seconds, they've taken money out of your account and authorized it. We trick the very same system to seeing these scoring calls as these high priority credit card authorizations. So they're brought back to a massive facility in Sunnyvale, just down the street from our offices, and then they're processed and presented to our computer so that we can determine whether you cheated or not and how you did.
Well, I like that. Cheating on interactive network. This is another...
it's another issue, right?
Another issue that we have. Now, we've talked about football games, and we're talking about game shows. And I also saw some things like Murder, She Wrote. And now, how would you interact with that?
Well, that's a great question. What we have been doing for the last 5 years is dealing with real paying customers or people in real field trials, asking them what it would be, what they would like to do with a particular class of programming, and then a specific program, and then we reiterate that through a variety of test marketing and perfect it. And it was very easy to do game shows because you basically are playing the game show, and sporting events are obvious too, in that there's a certain thing that goes on in your mind. Murder, She Wrote is another relatively obvious one, and that what that show really is electronic Clue. And so we formalize that. We let you predict who's going to get murdered, what the weapon will be on a separate screen, on another screen, who the murderer was, what were their motives. We've distilled all possible motives for murder down into 7 possibilities, I think. And then the clues that Jessica will rely upon that will solve the crime. Those points values on those screens are dropping from, say, 50,000 to 0 in the course of the hour. So you can continually change your mind, but every time you do, you get a less point value for that solution. And at the end, we add up the value of the screens, collect them, and that's your total score in Murder, She Wrote. That was easy. The Nightly News, or McNeil Lair, or the 60 Minutes, or Oprah, or Donahue, we're doing what they're trying to do is to get you involved mentally and to express your opinion, whether you shout it in out at the television or writing a letter. What we're doing is asking a series of questions in real time about what you think about what you're hearing, whether you agree or disagree, what the solutions might be. And then at the end of the program, instead of having winners, we show you where you stood relative to all the other people that participated, which is fascinating to see whether you're really in the mainstream or off in left field on those things. What has been challenging are shows like sitcoms to make them more fun and to add to the enjoyment of the viewers without stepping on the fundamental point of the program, which is humor and surprise. We've done that now, but it's taken a long time to figure out how to crack that one.
Well, what's the clue there?
Well, the clue there is that the people that watch sitcoms become very involved with the characters. I mean, they're an ensemble, and the characters have a repetitive, a predictable personality. And so we've come up with a wonderful concept where before the show starts, you're given a brief description of a scenario that's going to come up and a line, and you predict which one of the characters would say such a thing. Or you would have a character and you would predict which of the 4 things that we have down there would he say. Then you watch the show, and as the show unfolds, you hear the interactive control unit telling you whether you were right or wrong about each one of those. But what we could not do is have you so involved with the interactivity that you miss the funny line or you miss the lines. And so in testing, it has worked amazingly well, and it's actually brought people to shows like Seinfeld that never watched it because they can see that there's a point there and a regularity to the humor just in the concept that we present to them.
This is like video games for adults.
Absolutely. For prizes.
And for prizes. This is great. As an engineer and a person who's worked around computers and systems for years and years and years, we were always talking about interfaces. I mean, how do you interface with something, and how do you show the data, and what's the easy way to get it in and to get it out, and can you? It's so complicated. Can you see it this way? I can tell you this is the first application I've ever seen that takes all of the technology and the know-how about how humans interact and brings it into an area I don't think we've had before.
It really truly does, and I think one of the reasons that it's able to be rolled out nationwide is that we are combining a bunch of technologies that over the years have been driven down in their cost and have been deployed nationwide, and so that we're not waiting for some custom-made information highway to be laid. We will be delighted when that comes and we can leverage the new speed and communications and the variety of programming that you can get from that. But right now we're ready to take some wonderful invention and some wonderful technology and combine it in a unique way to deliver interactivity, this year to 93 million homes.
My guest today is David Lochtin, CEO and Chairman of Interactive Network, which has such investors as NBC, Gannett, TCI, and AC Nielsen. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm just sort of amazed at how much is going on here. You're dealing with all the prime programs. You're talking about Super Bowls, you're talking about game shows, you're talking about primetime television shows. The idea that finally you've gotten the technology and you've done obviously a lot of pilot studies and you're rolling out across the board, it's like exploding all at once. How do you deal with this explosion?
Gosh, I don't know. I look at the success of companies here in Silicon Valley, like Apple and Sun, for instance, that exploded and survived. but it's pretty frightening. I mean, we have gone from 125 to 355 people between now and September, expanding our office space from 14,000 square feet to 80,000 square feet as we light up the production capability of producing every single sporting event that's on television centrally from one location with 30-some satellite dishes on the roof of our new building. So it's pretty frightening, but we've been rehearsing and practicing for this for some time, and some of our investors are saying, you know, what's taken so long? So.
That clear view, short distance problem
exactly.
Again. Now, let's just in round numbers say, just about what does somebody have to pay if you're in one of the areas?
Sure.
What are we talking about?
Well, the final pricing is undergoing some final testing, and we just believe in going into the market and dealing with people at arm's length. But I would say that $15 a month is a likely price for the service. Then, of course, there's the control unit, and whether we charge another $5 or $10 a month for the lease of that or you buy it, is still under final test. But I think that what people correctly focus on is the long-term recurring cost of being able to interact with television programming. And at $15 a month, you get to do 120 events a day and see how you would have done. And then we will charge you extra to compete for prizes. And one of the things that we've discovered in all of this market testing is that when you have games of skill, and we truly do because we would be in trouble with the state lottery commissions and so forth if we were awarding prizes while we're charging people money, if we were in a sweepstakes business, so the games are clearly games of skill. We've discovered that in all games of skill, there are people that are very good, and there are people that are outstanding, and there are people that are less talented. And so it becomes a disincentive to enter into a contest where you cannot win because you're not practiced enough or you're not up on the learning curve. We have spent 3 years, therefore, working on some very sophisticated software that will allow people in each one of these games to work their way up a ladder of some 5 levels, from the challenger to the legend level at the top, so that you compete against people of like skill and have a chance to win. Therefore, you have a chance to win a prize. When that becomes understood by people, I think that you're going to find a lot of closet competitors that have this risk-free situation where if they do badly one night, nobody knows, but they get their name in lights every now and then because they found a game, a program that they have mastered, a contest around it that they are good at, and they are not forced to compete against the pros until they're ready to take on the pros. So this is very important to the overall satisfaction, is to let people have a chance to win prizes.
Yeah. Now, there are a few places where you can already get interactive antlers.
Yes, we have been in the Bay Area here in Sacramento, where we did our field trials in 1990 in 225 homes, and then came into the Bay Area in mid-1991, and then went to Chicago at Christmas time of this year, 93, January of 94. And we've been doing a variety of things there with pricing and with trying to explain it, quite frankly, trying to explain something that never existed before when there is no quick comparison. You know, radio was, well, you can hear the vaudeville show in your home, or you can listen to the ball game in your home, and television was, you can see it, and color television was obvious. What we're talking about, as you can see, is not really simply explained in a matter of 60 seconds.
Okay, so you've test marketed then in Chicago. When is it going to roll out across the rest of the country?
After Labor Day, when everyone comes back from vacation, NBC, our major investor, will start to drive you crazy, as they did with the Peacock when you couldn't see the color, you know, and when they did with stereo, saying the following program is in stereo where available. You will see our little lion logo and an announcement, the following program is interactive where available. And we will be available nationwide, so then you will have to see one of our direct response commercials, a 60-second or an infomercial of a half hour, and be able to pick up the phone, get a number, and dial us and order the service from us. And that'll start, as I say, in the fall.
Now, I'm a little interested. I always like to follow the money trail on this. Now, are the networks going to pay you?
No.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, we have two ways of our company making money. One is from the subscription revenues. The sale of the hardware, the lease of the hardware, eventually goes away as it gets incorporated into all kinds of laptop computers and personal digital assistants and the TV set and the cable box. But over time, advertising revenue will be an important source of revenue. The advertiser is spending billions and billions of dollars. Take the classic example of Chrysler, which recently joined our advertising consortium. When they run an ad on the Super Bowl, the neon ad, for instance, they are only looking for one of 200 people that are thinking about buying a car that might be in the neon class at any one time, and therefore there's a lot of waste in that advertising. We were able, in a very simple experiment with them, to take what was a 6% recall of the public at large and watching the Super Bowl, even remembering that they saw one of three neon commercials, up to 59% of the people asking for more information and 89% being able to answer copy points about the neon simply by beeping them right before the commercial and saying, you're going to be asked some questions about the forthcoming neon commercial and you might want a T-shirt. The advertiser will be involved in working out with us a way to involve the viewer in a dialogue, not only for information requests, for the ability to win coupons in the home, the ability to get more information about a product, all of which will not only be of value to the advertiser who will pay us money, but to the viewer as well who's busy, who doesn't want to necessarily become involved with every commercial, but will select those that's got a product of certain interest to him. So there is that. The money flow going out goes to the people that own those valuable copyrights. When we do Wheel and Jeopardy, they're owned by Merv Griffin. Merv Griffin Associates is owned by Sony Entertainment. We pay them a royalty for their cooperation in adding interactivity and promoting the availability of an interactive entertainment experience around that program. And so we incentivize them. And while our system is patented, we look forward to giving away the chips to the people that make the hardware so that they can make all of these hardware, quote, interactive compatible or interactive ready.
So you'd go into Circuit City or the Good Guys and you'd say, well, you know, I really much prefer this control unit here because it fits on my Easy Boy recliner versus so you're seeing
a variety of choice. Plus, they'll say when you want to buy this new high-definition television VCR, they'll say, do you want one that's interactive compatible? And you'll say, what's that? And they say, that lets you play along with interactive network and you don't have to have any other hardware, and that's $25 extra for that feature. So it'd be like surround sound or some of these things that are now in the marketplace.
And as if this wasn't enough, you have a new joint venture with Sega.
Well, the implications of our software and the ability to keep people from cheating and allow them to compete against one another in a variety of skill levels has terrific applications for video games and multimedia games and computer games, as well as programming that you can see on television. And Sega, we've jointly licensed one another under a separate patent, and we're working in our multimedia division to bring interactive game competition, video game, computer game, for prizes, college scholarships, and leverage the educational potential that this new multimedia software, the edutainment and educational potential that a feedback mechanism can provide so that you can see and get graded on how well you're doing. So that is another part of what we're developing that rides on the same airwaves and on the same data and on the same software that we've been developing for 6 years.
I talk to people all the time about technology, and I talk to them about what changes are going to happen, and I am absolutely stupefied at how many different elements are coming in to what you're trying to do. And, of course, now it's just here, so I imagine in the beginning it was pretty overwhelming.
Well, you know, if you knew what you were going to be faced with when you started, you probably never would have started. But we have had an interesting group of people. I think that we probably must set a record in Silicon Valley for low employee turnover. I think we've averaged 4%, and when the average is 30% for all Silicon Valley companies. And included in that group are a cadre of the world's finest real-time software programmers, literally the team leaders of the people that did the space shuttle, the stealth fighter, the stealth bomber, the Apache helicopter, virtual reality flight simulators were brought over out of that very demanding environment and put together with some people that had pioneered the data broadcasting technology that I started at DataSpeed back in 1981. And there at the end of the food chain and at the front are a bunch of world-class marketeers that launched the Macintosh computer, the IBM computer that invented the Pong, home Pong, and the Atari 2600 and started the video game industry, going into homes and telling people, if you had this capability, what would you do with it? And so the process is kind of running back to the engineers and says, they want to do this. They want to compete in, you know, skill levels. And then having these people program the software to make all that work. And that is why I think that as we get ready to go nationwide, we have 89% of our customers satisfied with the service, which is an astounding number when you think about it.
Well, you wrote 1 million lines of code.
Now we're over 2 million.
Two million.
That's, no, we wrote a lot more code than that. That's stuff that was working.
That's what you kept.
Yeah, that's the stuff that we kept.
Have you learned anything about software, David?
Well, I've been involved in managing software development since 1981, and I had black hair when I started, and it's getting rather gray now. But yes, I'm not a programmer, but I know that when you deal with the development of software, you're dealing with some very unusual people and some very talented people who are motivated and managed in very unusual ways at times.
That's great. David, I hope you can come back and talk to us again after you have some more experience across the country. Find out what's going on and what happened.
We'd be delighted to share that with you.
Terrific. Thanks so much. My guest today has been David Lochten, CEO and chairman of Interactive Network. Interactive Network will be rolling out interactive television services throughout 1994. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. While there's been a great deal of public awareness about saving the rainforest, many people don't understand that when you lose a rainforest, it's not a single isolated event. Katie Moran is the executive director of the Healing Forest Conservancy. I asked her to describe all that is affected when we lose a rainforest.
It's not just the forest disappearing. It's a whole complex of the people that live there, the rest of the ecosystem that the forest encompasses disappearing. Those are animal species as well as plant species. The climate situation that is related to forests, they can either be sources or sinks of carbon dioxide when it comes to global warming issues. That's just a small part that we know of now. We don't know how what the hydrological cycles of forests, large forests, say the Amazon basin, are contributing to oceans and how that works as well. So when a forest disappears, we're tinkering with a system that we know really very little about. And it just seems to me to be a foolish and frivolous way of us thinking that we can cut trees down for very short-term profits when in the long term, so much more is at stake.
I think everyone is familiar with the fact that some rock stars got involved in rainforests and there were some concerts, and I don't think we've heard that much lately, so I guess everything's been all solved.
Wrong.
Like the facetious way. Can you give us a picture for what has been happening and where we are today?
Sure. To put it very shortly and succinctly, the rate of tropical deforestation has almost doubled. In the last decade, yeah.
It has not slowed down.
No, it has increased. And in some areas, it's decreased. There's new data out on the Amazon that the deforestation there has actually decreased. But in other parts of the world, it's increased, which I think shows you just how little we know about this. We don't know how many species, for example, are housed in forests. Tropical forests, given their evolutionary role of species that have co-evolved with each other, we haven't been able to count them, let alone to figure out just how useful they are and what kind of role they can play in not only our future, but future generations.
Now tell us about the Conservancy and how it got started and what it's about.
The Healing Forest Conservancy was named after a book by Richard Evans Schultes, who's widely considered the father of a really interesting field called ethnobotany. Schultes wrote The Healing Forest he's at Harvard now, professor emeritus. And the book is largely considered a reference book for some of the hallucinogenic plants from the rainforest. So given that Schultes' background and his contribution to the field is so great, Shaman Pharmaceuticals decided to name the Healing Forest Conservancy after his book. I have to tell you a little bit about Shaman before I can tell you about the Conservancy. As the name implies, Shaman Pharmaceuticals is a natural products pharmaceutical company that uses traditional knowledge, indigenous knowledge of people that have lived in rainforests for hundreds, sometimes thousands of years, with biotic species, and we're strictly looking at plants at this stage, and their use for medicines for the people in their villages. And that's what Shaman is. It's a pharmaceutical company that uses natural products, plants, and the chemicals that are involved in those plants to look at how these chemicals can be used for therapeutics for healthcare issues today, a very important question in our country. So that's just part of what the Conservancy does. It's conservation of biological diversity and cultural diversity, a term that I think needs to be combined when you're talking about it in this context. I refer to it as biocultural diversity. My job specifically is to recognize and actually get back to the indigenous groups that Shaman has worked with, and they have contributed their, to a large degree their intellectual capabilities of how to use medicinal plants to the Shaman process of drug discovery. They deserve compensation for this, of course. And Shaman set up a specific organization, namely the Healing Forest Conservancy, to do that.
We've had the Shaman Pharmaceuticals people on the show. Steve King with them, ethnobotanist. And he was saying that to really be an effective drug or an effective application or agent, you have to take the plant, and then you've got to use the indigenous people's experience with how do you prepare it, how do you use it, and what cases do they work. And it's all of that together that makes it effective. And the Conservancy is committed not just to the plants themselves, but to the peoples in there. What have you done to go forward with
that? Well, haven't done it yet. I think it's important to say that at this stage, while Shaman is a young company with no products yet, it has managed to get two products to clinical trials, to phase two of clinical trials in record time, about half the time that it typically takes for any other pharmaceutical company. So when a product is commercialized, and again, that has not happened yet, but we're very much ahead of the pack when it comes to a time frame on how to do that. When a product is commercialized, then my job kicks in. They will take a percentage of product profits and funnel it back into the Conservancy. And what I do then is to get that money back to all the indigenous groups that Shaman has ever worked with.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Katie Moran. She's the executive director of the Healing Forest Conservancy. Let's talk about some of the projects which you're supporting. First of all, let's talk about Medicine Woman.
Ah, that's my favorite. I like it because I'm a woman, and I have seen that there have, even in our culture, women are excluded. This is not something new that I'm telling you today, but they've been excluded from the process of empowerment in their lives and their careers simply because they're women. We have taken steps today to change that, I think rather successfully. The rest of the world has not done that. Now, I'm going to say it needs to be done on the one hand, but on the other hand, I'm going to say it needs to be done where it's culturally appropriate. And that's a very complex question to answer. But where communities choose to let and encourage and have women become involved to get a job, to gain a technical skill, to demonstrate use for their village, then Medicine Woman can kick in. It's a project that will provide small grants to Indigenous women to give them technical training and education on how to use plant resources in a way that teaches them the Western system. While we want to encourage and strengthen the traditional system out there, we also need to empower them on what it, through knowledge of how the Western system works. Number one, those plant resources are very valuable to them. As the Convention on Biodiversity kicks in, I hope we'll talk about that later, it's recognized that Indigenous communities should share in any benefits, that any commercial benefits that come from using those plants. And countries are now recognized as having sovereignty over their plant resources, something that was not done before the convention. So that's how Medicine Woman can kick in, by providing, if you will, prior informed consent to groups locally on the ground as to the value of their biotic resources, and letting, putting them in a position where they can make decisions on if they want to use them locally, if they want to in some way participate in some of these plant collections that are going on. And that can be done through this technical training, just simply very simple methods of plant collections, using a plant press, et cetera, identification. You can identify the local terms and the local use of the plant, as well as some of the Western taxonomy, very, very simple again, but starting out very simply and then jumping into as complex a system as they choose.
Well, I did see throughout all of this the term again and again, where the program suits local needs. So I guess there's a matching. You could actually do some damage if you really weren't sensitive to what their needs
are. That's been done in the past. I think what I follow is, I try to follow, is number one, when you go into a country, do no harm. That's the most important thought. And the close second on that is, there is no model. There is no pattern. Medicine Woman is a concept rather than a project itself that's going to be followed very strictly. I think that one of the things we in the conservation movement has learned is people and species and countries have very different agendas, and those agendas change over time. And to try to develop one system or set that's going to work for everybody for all time is looking for disaster.
Now, in supporting these local Indigenous women to be able to inventory and collect the plants that are there, this does bring up the Convention on Biodiversity and the effort to document the plants of the world. How much don't we know?
Well, our highly industrialized country does not have an inventory of our plant species here in the United States of America.
So we don't know how many plants are there.
That's right. And we're a country that has relatively fewer plants rather than when you're looking at some of the tropical countries who are what we call today the gene-rich countries. Inside these plants are chemicals and genetic material inside of that. And so you're really looking at gene-rich countries of the South or the tropical countries versus the gene-poor countries of the North, our culture, our country. And I think if you look at it that way, you're putting this whole context of North and South cooperation in a whole different concept, different way. Instead of saying developed countries and less developed countries or developing countries, you're saying, you're talking about the value of the species that are there. There are gene-rich countries and there are gene-poor countries, and we're the latter.
What did the convention say about taking inventories of plants?
The convention, number one, I have to say, gives me great hope to see something like this happening. And having said that, I'm from Washington, so I can say that a lot. I must say that it's rather vague in some of its precepts, but it's really an excellent first step towards what I think the world is now recognized as a really urgent crisis, and that is that we're losing biotic species. The convention states, number one, that the 165 countries that have already signed on to it all recognize that we're losing species and that there is a need for conservation of species. The second important point that the convention stresses is that those species should be viewed as natural resources that can be used sustainably, and that sustainable is the kicker word in that. The third part of it is what I'm working on specifically, and that is that the people that own those species and, in my case, the knowledge of how to use those species should share equitably in any kind of compensation out of that use.
There is a concept that said if you look at the Earth and you look at all the plants on it, you can consider that data. And when you look at the humans on it who have learned to live with the plants and how to use them, then the data becomes information.
We're always very good. Yes, I like that.
Very important to have that distinction. My guest today is Katie Moran, Executive Director of the Healing Forest Conservancy. Earlier, she was an anthropologist with the Smithsonian Institution. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm really fascinated by the project that you have called Terra Nova in Belize. Would you tell us about that?
I sure will. It's, to me, a fascinating project, too. And it is indeed new land. It's a new way of looking at how to do this thing we call conservation. And that is by giving local control to the people who will use these biotic species, deeding them ownership, management, and sustainable use of a 6,000-acre, what we're calling the world's first ethnobiomedical plant reserve. There's a group down there called the acronym BATH, Belize Association of Traditional Healers. They have formed an association for two reasons. Number one, they wanted to have an association that could receive any profits from any commercialization of their plant use and plant knowledge, and they chose to funnel profits back through the BATH. They represent the many different Maya communities that are there, Garifuna. There are nine different cultures in Belize, and it represents just about all of the BATH represents just about all of those cultures. They also wanted to have management of the reserve in their name. So they formed the BATH in order to manage Terra Nova, is the name of the reserve. And they did it for very practical reasons. Number one, several of these healers are quite old. Probably the most famous healer in Central America is Don Alejo Ponte. It was my pleasure to meet him last December. He is, I believe, 102 years old. It's difficult to say exactly. I've heard 97 and I've heard 102. And
after 90, who cares?
That's right. So there are people like Don Alejo who understandably can't go out into the forest anymore and get their plants that they use to heal local people with. And incidentally, it should be stated here that Belize, along with other countries in the South, depend on traditional healing, largely plant-based traditional healing, for about 80% of the population of their countries. That's a lot of people that are using plants to get well. So I'm off track a little bit, but the BATH wants the reserve in the name of their association so they can manage it and so that they can decide how the plants will be used. For example, they want people to do the collecting for them. In the past, a healer had maybe just to walk out his door or go, you know, a very short distance to get the plants that they needed for health care. Today, with the deforestation we've been talking about, the forests have receded, and it's sometimes an impossible distance for them to go to collect their own plants. Actually, a very good study by Michael Balick from the New York Botanical Garden, who has already gathered data on the economics of local people collecting plants And it comes out very favorably as a career for local people. So the Bath, to me, represents a whole new way of doing things. I'm pleased to say that the Conservancy was able to support financially some of their needs. The impetus, again, for this project came from them, and they approached me recognizing the goals of the Conservancy, and that takes money. Not a lot of money, but I was able to send money down largely thanks to the support of the Rex Foundation, which has helped me with some of these projects. The Rex Foundation, incidentally, much of the money comes from concerts by the Grateful Dead, a local group that has been aware of the use of plants for not might, generations, but, well, perhaps generations is the right way to say it.
They may have some knowledge from using them.
That's right. Mickey Hart has done a wonderful job in using the music of indigenous groups and incorporating that, learning from them, and he has given back in return at the Smithsonian. He's helping them maintain a record of that music.
Another project that you have, the Usco Amazonian School of Painting. I'm an engineer, and so my first reaction was, what does painting have to do with conserving the rainforest? And then I realized when you draw something, you see it. Brings it to your consciousness. And I thought, it's true. Tell us about the school.
That's right, and art does represent what's going on in the culture at the time. It's a wonderful story. There was a shaman named, they're called Vegetalista in Peru, where Pablo Amarengo lives. Pablo was a shamanista for many years and decided that he really wanted to document in some way the plants in his culture, recognizing that largely, there's an oral tradition of how to use these plants for therapeutics. He decided to paint them. He is in Pucallpa, which is a river city on the Peruvian Amazon, a mixture of people, not only different cultural groups, but people in different stages of economic development, from very poor river people to indigenous peoples to citified groups. As he was painting, some kids came up to him, as kids do, and said, "What are you doing? Can I try it?" And he's a nice guy. And he said, "Sure." And he showed him how to use it and let him have some paints. And they loved it. And today he has trained over 600 children how to paint the botanical species of the Peruvian Amazon. He received a Global 500 Award for his work, really recognized internationally, not only for his training of children from the Peruvian rainforest, but also because it's very good art. Many of the elders go into the forest with the children as they're painting, and they talk about myths and the traditions associated with different plants. So I see this not only as teaching children how to paint and represent their worldview and offering perhaps some kind of economic opportunities for them, but also a real strengthening of their cultural identity.
And passing down of the knowledge.
That's exactly right. That's what it's all about.
I was reading your resume, and I'm not used to reading resumes like yours, and I got a couple of chuckles out of it. I love your research entitled Traditional Elephant Management and Its Implications for Conservation and Development. I mean, I can tell you what they're going to do, Katie. They're going to walk all over those plants you're trying to save. Here's another good one. Long-term captive rattlesnakes. It's like, don't go near them. I mean, is your career a Far Side cartoon? Katie, I have to ask you.
Well, may I say that if Gary Larson's out there listening, I swear he's living in my mind because he's done neat things on anthropologists and particularly on elephants and on elephant management, elephant training for mahouts or elephant keepers.
So you started out with animals and then you ended up with humans and plants.
That's right.
Your picture keeps getting bigger, Katie.
That's right. It is that big a picture. I think what the conservation movement and the human rights movement has learned is that everything's linked. And you can't say, well, I'm going to look at tree conservation or wetlands or this or that. You really have to see a holistic view of it all.
No, I can't let you go without asking you one quick question. And is it, what did you learn talking to those camel drivers in East Africa? Where do they fit in the picture?
They fit in the picture, in the broad picture, In exactly the same way. It's just a different species and a different group of people in a different part of the world. I was part of a huge UNESCO project in the early 80s, and my role was very small, but it really made me see how culture is a very important part of development that has largely not been looked at. What I learned from the Gabbro camel pastoralists you're talking about is that here you have a group of nomad camel pastoralists living in probably the hottest, driest part of Africa, and yet they had, as I saw, a very nice life system and a very strong culture. And they had one prime natural resource that they could make their living with, and that was camels. And the unique and complex system of social organization that they developed within their own culture was quite admirable, which has allowed them the ability to have a decent living and to use camels as a form of development and yet not deplete this resource, the camels in Africa.
So we see the lesson in small microcosms, and we try to make the whole of the planet work the same way.
That's exactly right.
Katie, thank you so much for joining
us. My pleasure.
My guest today has been Katie Moran, Executive Director of the Healing Forest Conservancy. The Conservancy is dedicated to halting the accelerated extinction rates of biological species and the erosion of the cultural diversity of forest peoples. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Evans' perspective today is called Knives, Forks, Spoons, and Neanderthals.
Are we descended from Neanderthals? Maybe. Although anthropologists have been working on the problem for over a century, there's still no definitive answer. For a simple and simplistic way to visualize two extreme points of view about how Neanderthals fit into our lineage, get a knife, fork, and a teaspoon. The knife represents the species Homo erectus, ancestral to both ourselves and Neanderthals. The teaspoon stands for Neanderthals, and the fork is us, Homo sapiens. In the Neanderthals are our ancestors model, place the knife sideways on your left with its tip touching the bottom of the spoon, which sits sideways in front of you. The spoon's tip, in turn, touches the bottom of the fork on your right, so you have a straight line. Knife, fork, spoon. That is, Homo erectus, knife, evolved into Neanderthals, spoon, who later evolved into us, fork. For the Neanderthals are our cousin model, put the knife on your left, but now place the spoon and the fork parallel and side by side on your right, with the tip of the knife touching the ends of both the spoon and the fork. This model represents the Homo erectus, evolving into both Neanderthals and ourselves. We use a teaspoon to show that Neanderthals stop short of the present time, which is represented by the tip of the fork. In fact, the last Neanderthal died out about 30,000 years ago. Between these two extremes, Neanderthals are our ancestors and Neanderthals are our cousins, lie many shades of gray. For instance, some anthropologists hold that a subset of early Neanderthals broke off from the main Neanderthal line. They then gradually became a separate species as they evolved into our ancestors. The issue is clouded by deciding at what point, if any, Neanderthals and modern-type humans became separate species, that is, when a union of the two couldn't result in children. The fossil record is not surprisingly reticent on the subject. Archaeologists working in Israel have recently established, however, that Neanderthals and modern humans lived in the same caves and used the same tools for tens of thousands of years, although whether they were actually living there at the same time is a matter of controversy. Despite the fact that such basic questions as where do Neanderthals fit in our lineage and why did they die out some 30,000 years ago remain unanswered, the last few decades have given us a much clearer picture of these near humans. far from the brutish, bent-kneed caricatures that were commonplace in books of my not-too-distant childhood, Neanderthals are now known to have ornamented themselves, cared for their sick, and buried their dead. With brains as large as ours and bodies more robust than any Olympic weightlifter, they were able to survive in tough, cold conditions for millennia. Indeed, if they were our ancestors, we'd have nothing to be ashamed about in our family albums.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.